The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:40 in the afternoon on Monday, April 2nd, 2007. There's a quorum here to do business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Terrio, Senator Wilikowski, my French, and myself, Senator French. We've got two items on the agenda today, SB 112 and SB 97. Let's take up SB 112 first. This bill has had one hearing already, and we were careful to schedule it over to today to make certain that we heard from both sides of the issue. And today we have beginning witnesses, Mr. Jim Gorski. So, Mr. Gorski, if you would come forward, identify yourself, state your affiliation, if any. The committee would be happy to hear your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Senator French.
My name is Jim Gorski, and in a few short weeks, I'm going to be beginning my 31st year as a resident of the state of Alaska. My wife and I'm a practicing attorney in Anchorage. I count among my clients that I'm presently involved with right now the Society of Jesus Oregon Province, otherwise known as the Jesuits. I've been tasked today to speak to the committee briefly on a number of issues with respect that are presented with respect to SB 112, and basically approach it from the point of view that from which I know best, which is I'm involved with litigation involving issues to which this bill addresses in its tentative form. That's one of the jobs as a lawyer. You got to find these sorts of things, advise your client what potentially is presented by the bill and what the ramifications are. And as a consequence, I'd like to make a few comments with respect to the proposed bill. As we all know, SB 112 seeks to make a retroactive change to the statute of limitations for certain civil actions alleging felony sexual assault or abuse. It's a serious crime. Sexual abuse is a serious crime which must be eradicated from our society, and virtually nobody questions that whatsoever. However, Senate Bill SB 112 does not assist in that goal. It's not really a measure to deter or prevent sexual abuse. Instead, it seeks to create a retroactive suspension of the statute of limitations to allow adjudication of potentially expired legal claims. Now, I approach this as first and foremost a lawyer, which is what I am. And as we all know, the statutes of limitations are created so that there is a time period in which a criminal or a civil action must be initiated, and they exist to preserve the integrity of the process. Now, the question probably could be asked, if anybody was wronged for any reason whatsoever, why not file suit at any time? 10 years, 20 years, 40 years. I promise to paint your house and you give me $1,000, I don't paint the house. Why can't you come and make a claim against me 20 years later or 40 years later, as the case may be? And the answer to that is virtually since the formation of our country, and even beyond that, in the English common law, statutes of limitations were recognized as a necessary component for a fair and well-ordered system of jurisprudence. They are. A Supreme Court of the United States has suggested that they're vital to the welfare of society, and they're found and approved in all systems of enlightened jurisprudence. Our own court, Supreme Court, last year said much the same in a case where they commented that statutes of limitations attempt to strike a balance between ensuring that claimants have enough time to file a claim and protecting persons from due process concerns that arise when subjected to stale claims. Due process of law is something that we're all very cognizant of, and it's a fundamental constitutional right that requires substantial fairness in the resolution of disputes in our system of jurisprudence. The due process concerns underlying statutes of limitations and the reasons why these are recognized as important to preserving the integrity of the process have to do with the increased difficulties in obtaining reliable adjudications with older claims. By creating a reasonable time period in which a legal claim must be initiated, statutes ensure that the courts, and equally important and more important, that the juries decide the facts of a case based on reliable and competent and complete evidence. Now, courts and common sense, just put on our hat of common sense, have recognized that adjudications become less reliable with the passage of time. It's just human nature. Over time, the risk grows that evidence may be lost or key witnesses may disappear or die. The testimony of available witnesses also becomes less reliable over time as memories fade and recollections of events are colored by intervening experiences. The classic example, people get back together at a high school reunion and they talk about, do you remember? And one person remembers it radically different from the other, yet they were both at the same place. The intervention of time makes lots of differences as people try to put these things together. What statutes of limitations do as a consequence is that they reduce the danger of mistakes and erroneous decisions by encouraging parties to assert legal claims when the evidence is still fresh. So, what they do is they give us stability in the law and they give us some stability to society in general. They encourage the prompt resolution of disputes and they allow the parties to predict their potential legal liabilities and risks with regard to making decisions and other sorts of investment types of issues. So, Alaska, no different than most other states of the country, has statutes of limitations that apply to virtually all types of claims, from contract to tort. As a general matter, most tort claims in our state are subject to a 2-year statute of limitations and ultimately what we would call a 10-year statute of repose. The length of these time limitations is typical to the length of time limitations virtually across the country, with very few exceptions. In applying statutes of limitations, the key issue is the accrual date of the cause of action. The accrual date is the date on which the statute begins to run. Now, as a general principle, the accrual date of a tort action is the date on which the injury is inflicted. Alaska, again, like most other jurisdictions, however, has a number of tolling provisions which provide exceptions to the general rule. And these tolling provisions are very important to your consideration of SB 112. The tolling provisions delay the time that the statute of limitations begins to run to ensure that the limitations are applied fairly. What are some examples? Well, if you're a minor, if you're under the age of 18, the statute is tolled until you reach the age of 18, and then there's an additional period of time granted so that as an adult you can exercise your rights under the law. There's an incapacity tolling. If you're physically or mentally incapable of exercising your rights, the law is not going to be held against you. There is a delayed discovery tolling, which is not in our statute, but of course it's in the case law as articulated by the Alaska Supreme Court and most courts around the country. This tolling provision applies to persons who do not immediately appreciate that they have been injured by somebody's tortious conduct. Under the delayed discovery tolling, the statute does not begin to run until the plaintiff or the claimant knows or reasonably should have known that this person's allegedly tortious conduct injured them. So it's a discovery process. And the classic example that we all think about when we were in school is if you're in for surgery and a surgeon accidentally leaves a sponge in the stomach, you don't know that a stomach or the sponge is in there. Leaving the sponge in the stomach is the wrongful event. But if you don't know about it, you're not bound by that time period. But once your stomach starts to ache and they find out, hey, there was a sponge left in my stomach, you have an obligation. At that point, you're on notice that there was something happened and you need to exercise whatever rights or remedies you have under the law. So in short, the statute of limitations encourages prompt resolutions of dispute by prescribing time limits for filing legal actions. If a party is not at fault for delaying or for filing their legal claim under our law as it presently exists right now because they've not discovered the claim or they were incapacitated, the statutes of limitations and repose will often not prevent their claims. So what they do, however, is they apply to those claims where a claimant could have filed a timely action, had everything available to them, but for whatever reason they chose not to do so. Now, how will your proposed SB change Alaska law? As I read it, for tort claims involving allegations of felony sexual abuse, the applicable statute of limitations depends on when the claim arose. For claims arising before October 1, 2001, the general 2-year statute of limitation and 10-year statute of repose apply. subject to any relevant tolling provisions that we've just talked about. For claims arising after October 1, 2001, this body has modified, you know, the legislature has modified the statute of limitations prospectively to allow those claims to be initiated at any time. So SB 112 does not have any effect on prospective legal claims under the 2001 legislation. It will not affect any claims already preserved under current tolling provisions and exceptions to the statute of limitations or repose. Instead, what it does is make a narrow retroactive change to the law to affect only legal claims which may, depending upon the application of the tolling provisions, have expired. So I guess the question is, what's the purpose? If it's not going to serve any deterrence or prevention function, it seems to us that it's a bit problematic. Now, other than the state of California, retroactive legislation similar to what is proposed by SB 12 has been sought by and introduced in a number of states, including Colorado, Ohio, and Wisconsin, and those efforts were not successful. And for a variety of reasons, including some that I'll talk about here in just a moment. But basically, there's a recognition that there's a threat to the integrity of the legal process for these sorts of reasons. Number one, to retroactively suspend the statute of limitations impairs the reliability that we put in our system of jurisprudence to resolve disputes in a timely fashion where the evidence is fresh in everybody's mind. Such a retroactive suspension as proposed by the bill would allow plaintiffs to make allegations of past wrongdoing without any consideration for how long ago the alleged wrongdoing occurred. As a result, and again as I read it, public entities such as schools, correctional facilities, boroughs, cities, or private entities or nonprofits, the Boys and Girls Clubs, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, or religious organizations such as the institutions that I represent, risk being subjected to claims alleging misconduct many, many years ago, allegations of misconduct when virtually the people involved with those organizations today weren't even around, may not have even been in the state. SB 112 would also significantly increase the risk of potential inaccurate adjudications or even fraudulent claims. Although a plaintiff or claimant making an allegation is necessarily alive here and available to testify, the passage of time, particularly when we're talking about decades, makes it likely that other key witnesses and evidence would be unavailable to disprove or to challenge somebody's allegations. If the witness, the alleged perpetrator, is dead and the claimant or victim is alive, it's a one-way, it's not a dialogue, it's a monologue, and it's not the way our system of jurisprudence functions. Retroactively suspending the statute would also create difficulties in obtaining fair and accurate adjudications because the lack of notice that such claims would even be resurrected. Unlike the 2001 legislation, where everybody's on notice that prospectively, if an issue arises, you have an obligation to be prepared to defend that in the future. That's what the legislation said. Here, if there's no notice that exists on the record or in the statute or anywhere that suggests that these old claims could possibly be resurrected, and there was no notice given to parties or potential parties that they might need to maintain records or other evidence which might relate or possibly defeat those revived claims. If you have to go back 30 years ago and find records when even the IRS only wants them 6 years, and then they're routinely tossed out. At present, no person is being denied access to Alaska's legal system for these old claims. I can speak to that on firsthand knowledge. However, as the forum is chosen by claimants for resolution, i.e. the courts of Alaska, we necessarily have to look at those claims and evaluate those claims in rules of the light of the forum. I know many of you have had the chance to meet with Father Whitney, who has a standing offer to virtually anybody. He will meet with anybody anytime when schedules permit to sit down and talk about these sorts of claims. Not everybody takes us up on that offer for any number of different reasons. But of the claims that I am personally aware that I have been involved with for the last 3 years, there are claims, at least two from the 1950s, 34 from the 1960s, 60 in the 70s and only 7 in the 80s, and nothing subsequent to that. So in many respects, to the extent there was an issue that was created or involving sexual abuse with the institution that I'm involved with, that problem has pretty much resolved itself over the passage of time, and so now we're trying to make a long time look back. In the litigation in which I'm involved, of the 15 identified perpetrators that they wish to talk to, 10 are deceased. You know, and many of them, a number of them have been dead for 10, 20 years. Trial dates have been set in at least 8 matters, which comprise approximately 3/4 of the claims that we're involved with. So these cases are moving forward. They're being brought to resolution. And in the process, there's discovery ongoing. And at the end of the day, the law as it presently exists, which is what we think is fine, it strikes a proper balance between the rights of victims to come in and make their claim and the rights of the those who they're making their claims against. The fundamental fairness to both sides in these very tragic matters, it's a hard mix to reach, but at the end of the day, the Supreme Court in the law as it exists with the tolling provisions simply says to us involved with the litigation process, get involved, find out if there's a valid reason for the delay. If there's no valid reason for the delay, then you get to apply the statute, which, as we said, and as I said earlier, applies to virtually every claim in the state of Alaska, from contracts to tort. And as a result, it is our view that SB 112, by not being a prospective matter, is a matter that is best left to the law as it presently exists in the state. I thank you all very much, and I'll be happy to answer any questions as best I can.
Thank you, Mr. Gorski. Questions from members of the committee for Mr. Gorski?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
And question for you. Under the criminal, so there's no statute of limitations on a criminal. But for the offenses that we're talking about, for criminal charges, no statute of limitations?
No. There is a statute of limitations that was changed in 2001. In 2001, the legislature said, from this day forward, you can prosecute any sex crime whenever you get to court on it. But for those sex crimes that occurred in the past, you can't change the statute of limitations with respect to them because of the ex post facto clause.
Okay.
So a 1950s, 60s, 70s era sex assault, to which there may be a full confession, to which there may be a child support order entered, cannot be prosecuted criminally because of the ex post facto law.
Okay. And the burden of proof would have been much higher than for the civil?
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay.
Right. To a unanimous jury verdict.
Okay.
Correct. Now, the difference, of course, here is that there's no possibility of anyone going to jail, and the burden of proof is lower, preponderance of the evidence, but still requires a unanimous jury verdict. You have to convince all 12 jurors that...
10.
In Alaska, it's 10?
10.
Beg your pardon. I don't practice much civil law. I'm glad you're here.
I don't do criminal.
So there's that. Let me just ask you a couple questions, Mr. Gorski. Are you... you're not arguing about whether this is an ex post facto violation. You're basically arguing that the system has come to a balance, and the balance is better preserved by not looking backwards in the essential unfairness, if you will, in subjecting a defendant to a stale claim due to the expiration of witnesses and the faulty memories that grow up over years.
It could be a... As I read the ex post facto clause, it primarily focuses on criminal legislation, criminal types of statutes, as you mentioned earlier, Senator French. I think there is a potential constitutional concern about doing the same thing on the civil side, and each one is always a little bit factually oriented. It's one thing if the person, the alleged perpetrator, is still alive and here. It's another thing completely when the alleged perpetrator is dead and gone. So I think there are some constitutional concerns that which would potentially include an ex post facto type analysis. But I don't think it's called that in the civil sense because the ex post facto,
in your view,
is really a criminal
more criminally oriented
thing. Yes.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Gorski? Senator Huggins, yeah, and then Senator McGuire.
I'm assuming that we're talking about punitive effect of dollars. Is that what we're looking at here, civil-wise?
Senator French, to respond to Mr. Senator Huggins' inquiry. Yes, at the end of the day, the claims that are being asserted, in which I'm involved with, at the end of the day, it's a question of dollars. The church in Alaska, to my firsthand knowledge, has routinely offered counseling. Just come in and ask, and they will pay for counseling, and they have paid many, many dollars in that regard. But it's not just a function of paying for counseling or helping people get. It's a question of finding a just result. And I know that the Jesuits have worked mightily, Father Whitney has worked mightily to do that when having had the opportunity to help people. But at the end of the day, Senator Huggins, it is a question of dollars, and that's where it ends up.
Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, I read with interest, I think some members through the chair read with interest in the paper, this new concept of, can't think of the term, but it's where you're allowed to say that you have a revelation about something, but you don't have to reveal it because, in an ecclesiastical sense, God supersedes our government and our laws. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about that, and maybe you could remind me of the term. My apologies that I don't remember it, but I wanted to just hear your thoughts a little bit about how that plays into the cases. That's number one. And number two, I am interested in your point about people who may be dead and gone, and I wonder how other states have handled that particular part, because I know Senator French's bill is in keeping with a lot of other states, California in particular. How have they handled that fact?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, if I may respond. The doctrine that I think you were alluding to is what is called the doctrine of mental reservation, if I remember correctly. And to answer that question, a number of priests that have been deposed, and I've sat through many of these depositions, the plaintiff's lawyers have asked them to describe what that doctrine is, and then to say, well, you're not going to deal with that doctrine. They said, no, I took an oath to tell the truth, and I'm going to tell the truth. We're in a civil court of law here. We're not in an ecclesiastical court. For those of you that, as I understand the doctrine, and I am not a theologian, but the doctrine to a certain extent suggests that it may be okay to not tell the truth if there is a greater good that could perhaps be generated by that. And the example that they alluded to in the paper, if memory serves me, is that imagine you were in Nazi Germany and you had a Jewish family hiding in the cellar. And so the SS came and knocked on the door and they said, do you have a Jewish family here? And the response was, well, I suppose I could say no, in that they're not in the room with me right now, or no, they're not here, but by not telling them that they're in the basement, I'm doing a greater good. And there was some suggestion that maybe people aren't going to tell the truth under this doctrine of mental reservation, but my experience has been that when at least my clients, the people that have been deposed, under a deposition, a court of law, you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but, and they say they do. And I have no reason to think that it's anything other than a Middle Age anachronism that people like to throw out to see if we can't muddy the water a little bit more. But I don't think it has any particular relevance other than, frankly, to ask the question at the beginning to somehow cloud the testimony. It's like the question, when did you stop beating your wife?
Yeah.
Well, I never started. But as soon as you ask the question, there's a cloud that is cast on that.
Fair enough. On number two.
Number two. I'm not super familiar, and anything I said would be speculating on that issue. I believe that it has not, at least in California, posed an issue because I have a recollection that there was one person that was 90 years old, that was a claimant in the California cases, and I have to think that the alleged perpetrator was something, had been dead for a number of years. But I don't know, Senator. I don't have an answer for that.
Thank you.
Other questions from Mr. Gorski? Senator Terrio.
Did you testify that California is the only state that has opened up a window similar to this?
That is the most prominent state, that they had a one-year window, and they saw, like, multiple, a couple thousand different claims come in that window. I know Colorado, Wisconsin, and Ohio had proposals last year, and I do not believe they, well, I know they didn't, they did not pass. And different states have dealt with the issue. Those are the ones that I'm most familiar with right now, and I don't want to say as the definitive expert. I mean, I could get that information at some point in time, Senator Terrio, if you needed it.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. I apologize. I just thought of one other point or question that I want to line of questioning. You know, I've expressed my thoughts. I feel very strongly about the victims that underlie this, and I don't think you feel differently, nor do I believe that those who've come to meet with me feel differently. What I threw out in the meeting that I had was that if the goal was not to bankrupt, if you will, the churches or the underlying organizations, that perhaps a cap would be something I would consider on damages. The whole point to me behind this bill, as I expressed in my meeting, was it's to get access to the truth for the victims. And to me, that's the important part of it. And it's twofold. It's for those who are the victims to have some kind of validation that this happened to them, that it was real, that it wasn't just a made-up thing. That's number one. And number two, it's to hold, I guess it's threefold, it's to hold the person and the institution accountable if that is the truth. And through the discovery part of a civil court, you have access to whether or not that was the truth or not. And number three, it's to put the public on notice in the event that there are still individuals who committed this kind of conduct that are still out in our communities. And so to me, most people know here, I've been a big tort reformer. I mean, I don't really feel like there's enough money in the world ever to make people whole for the things that happened to them. That doesn't mean that I don't think we ought to try and that there ought to be claims and things, but I understand the point about bankruptcy and understand the point about statute of limitations. I'm sympathetic to all of it, but it seems like the other methods of trying to get at that information really haven't worked. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I support this bill. In fact, I wish it didn't have a one-year window, and I'll talk about that later. I feel like we're just kind of repeating the problem that the underlying law has, but I would be sympathetic to a cap on the damages, and I wondered if you'd thought about that.
Senator French, if I may respond. Senator McGuire. You had a couple of different points, and I'd like to sort of make sure I address them all. I think that what I would have to start off with is the suggestion that what we have right now isn't working, I think is a false premise.
Okay.
Unfortunately, many of these claims don't come about until my clients are served with a summons and complaint to say you're being sued. And immediately the opportunity to have any kind of a pastoral outreach is thwarted because they're represented by counsel. You have to go through counsel. I mean, the church in Alaska that I'm aware of, and I've lived here, I've seen the outreach. Give us, you know, there's in Anchorage, you can call the Archdiocese. If you don't want to call them, you can call STAR. You know, Standing Together Against Rape, as a neutral, you don't have to contact the church, but if you want to start a dialogue and begin the process, those mechanisms are in place and have been in place for a number of years. But they're not being exercised. What's happening is that a lawsuit is filed. And, okay, so who are these people? Who are they making a claim against? And then we start our own process, as any litigation process would be, okay, what are the facts? Let's go find out what records we may or may not have. Is the person alive, dead? Just all of that sort of thing. I can tell you that in the lawsuits that we've been involved with, there have been tens of thousands of documents in the discovery process that have been passed out and exchanged between the parties. Just, it's amazing what people keep. If there was a rhyme or reason to it, it'd be a lot better. But you got to remember back, if you're looking for information from the 60s and 70s, and these were missionaries, essentially, men that were in rural Alaska, they don't have a Xerox machine, filing cabinets. They were traveling from place to place. You may or may not have a letter that may or may not have said something. It's a potluck situation. But the law is, and what the courts have done, is to say before somebody is taken away or saying that you cannot exercise your rights and remedies, you're entitled to go through the discovery process. So we're doing that. We're spending hours, untold hours of time, gathering information in response. It's very easy to make a request for production in the litigation process. Provide us all documents that you have regarding X, either Father so-and-so or Mr. Smith. It doesn't matter whether it's religious institution or otherwise, but that information comes out, and it's only at, you know, so there access is being provided, is I guess what I wanted to say, and I'm here to tell you that firsthand knowledge, we know that to be the case. The second thing is, I think that in Alaska, every time there's any kind of a salacious anything, it's on the news. It's on the news in the TV, it's on the news in the paper. This is an issue that everybody knows about.
I want to make a point while you say that very briefly, if I
Senator
might.
McGuire.
I'm glad it's on the news.
Well,
I'm glad it's on the news. You know, this problem has been around for decades, and it was never on the news. It was in whispers, in small circles, in secrets. So if you're trying to sway me, you're not swaying me in the right direction. No. I'm glad it's on the news.
I don't dispute that at all, Senator McGuire. My only comment is that the as you know, the litigation process is one that, you know, that you want your ultimately you want your jury to hear the evidence in an untainted and unimpacted fashion. And when information comes out prematurely before all the facts are in, you potentially jeopardize the ability to get a fair trial.
Yeah.
I don't dispute for a moment that there's issues that need to be raised and that the media is one of the ways to do so. But as a lawyer and as in recognition of the fact that everybody, if you have to take a case to trial, is entitled to a fair and impartial trial without a tainted jury, when you get information that's submitted out that has nothing to do with anything, and some of the stuff that has been submitted out, I would submit, has nothing to do with the allegations we're involved with here, it doesn't necessarily serve the purpose for which, in an ideal world, it would serve.
Mr. Gorski, in the interest of time, let me give you 60 seconds to wrap up. I have other witnesses.
Cap was the question.
Interest in a cap.
Cap.
Yeah. I guess the cap issue, I can't speak for my client specifically on that. We haven't given that a lot of issue, but that again is another one of these policy decisions that, you know, how do you, as you said, Senator McGuire, in some situations, no amount of money is going to make it right. You know that. I know that. So if you're talking about a cap, at that point, I guess it's some sort of a public policy decision. But I would submit that, in summation, that the bills as it's presently proposed doesn't really work prospectively. It's really a retroactive look. Yeah. I think that the danger is that defending in situations where the alleged perpetrator is dead and gone, it raises serious constitutional issues. It's not a dialogue. It's not a traditional litigation situation. And the balance is recognized now. And remember, the statute of limitations, what you're talking about, is a question that is focused on the claimant. What did you know, and when did you know it? And if I could use my sponge analogy, once you found the sponge was in your stomach, does that mean that you could wait for 5 or 10 years before you filed suit against the surgeon? No, the law in the state says once you know, you have an obligation to exercise and see what your remedies are, and it would be 2 years from the day you found out the sponge was there. You could insert the words from one to the other, you know, a sexual abuse situation. Once you knew, were you entitled to wait until all the witnesses are dead and gone before you made your claim? Thank you.
Just on, actually, we have one more question from Senator Terrell, but just on that point, and just, I mean, I don't think you were here when we heard the testimony, but what we heard was about the fear that you experience when you're abused by someone in a position of authority, the shame you experience when you're abused by someone in a position of authority, about the resulting alcoholism and other serious life problems that these events give rise to. And we heard from a gentleman who, and this has just really been ringing in my mind because I have a son, who went to his father after he'd been abused by his priest, and his father beat him in exchange for that disclosure. And I just think about the psychological repression that results as a result of that beating, and I have a hard time analogizing that to a sponge and a surgery.
If I may,
and it's only fair to let you speak back to that, and then we'll go to Senator Terrell's question. Then we're going to have to wrap up.
I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
If I may respond to that, Senator French, what I think the issue really focuses on. I mean, I use the sponge just because it's a simple analogy, but as we know, these are far more complex and horrific. I mean, it's horrific. That's the appropriate word. But that's why the plaintiffs in those situations have experts such as Dr. Spurbeck, who I believe did testify. And if he can demonstrate to a reasonable level of certainty that for all of the reasons that you mentioned, they could not be in court until 2 years before the lawsuit was filed, they're okay under the law. Now, remember, it's once they knew all of that information, they've gotten past it. I mean, everyone's going to, we know it's embarrassing. We know it's horrific. I don't mean to demean or de-minimize it one iota. But the law as it exists now says once you get to that point, and that's what this process is under the discovery rule, once you get to that point, you have an obligation to move the case forward.
Senator Terrell.
That was one of the points that I wanted to make, Mr. Chairman, is that it's not so automatic that once you reach the age of 18, it starts ticking. You can make the case that for some psychological repression reason, you didn't meet that standard of knowing, and that's the point that that was just made. That's primarily what I wanted to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Gorski.
Thank you all
here.
Very much for your time today.
Quite
and
welcome.
If any other questions, and we're free to happy to help out as best we can.
Excellent. We also have
Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Senator
before
Terrell,
you leave,
please go ahead.
Can you tell me the connection between yourself, your client, your firm, and Bob Gross-Close and Cook Schuman and Gross-Close?
In the cases, Senator Terrell, through the chair again, in the cases in which we're involved, the Mr. Gross-Close represents the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska, or the Diocese of Fairbanks. And in the cases in which we are presently involved, the defendants include, if the person is alive, the live person, they include the diocese, which is the church entity, the corporate entity that exists for Northern Alaska, which is basically everything north of the 3rd Judicial District line. And then they include as well the Society of Jesus, the Oregon province, or the Jesuits. So I'm representing the religious order from which a number of these defendants, the priests, were from.
Okay.
And then Mr. Gross-Close represents the diocese itself. And so what would happen is that the Jesuits would allow these priests to go and serve in the diocese, and so they've got two different potentially liable parties is what they're looking for.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I wasn't sure what that connection was, and that last week at our press availability, I put on the record that Bob Gross-Close is a principal partner in my wife's law firm. And but I can certainly separate myself between that and what the policy call is. In fact, when I spoke to my wife, she said, well, passage of the bill would mean lots of litigation and bankruptcy, and that's what she does, and so it'd be great for her, but I just don't know that's the right policy.
Layer of asphalt on your driveway. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Gorski, for being
here.
We also have another witness who wants to testify, signed up to testify, and this is David Cloese. Mr. Cloese, if you'd come forward, please put yourself on the record, list your affiliation, if any, and I'm sorry, Ms. Cloese, but I'm going to have to limit you to about 5 minutes. We're just tight on time. I know you've come a long way,
I'll talk very quickly.
Start
thank
speaking.
Thank you, Senator. I'm David Clossy. I'm not an attorney. I am from St. Louis, Missouri. For the last 17 years, I've been the national director of a support group called SNAP, which is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. We have 8,000 members across the country. Three of my brothers were abused by the same priest who molested me. One of my brothers went on to become a Catholic priest, went on to molest kids himself. I would like to ask you to just remember one figure. The principal point I think that Mr. Gorski was trying to make is that the present system works. And if the present system works, how do we explain the fact that the FBI estimates that 90% of child molesters are never caught or prosecuted or convicted? 90%. I submit to you that obviously the present system does not work, and we have to take some efforts to deal with that horrific problem. The second general point I'll make is that we all have wonderful imaginations, and we can do what my mother used to call awfulizing very well. And we can spend hours speculating about potential future harm. What we tend as a society, I think, to be blind to is current actual harm. And the current actual reality is that there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of Alaska citizens who were molested by as children, who have no legal recourse, criminal or civil. As a matter of fact, the cab driver who brought me in from the airport last night asked me what I was in town for, and I told him, and as he dropped me off at the hotel, he said, "Good luck, it happened to me too." Fundamentally, this comes down to a question of prevention versus secrecy. There is no question, I've been involved again for 17 years, there's no question that this civil window is the, I believe, the single most effective way to prevent future abuse. And the simple reason is that there are child molesters out there now who have essentially run out the clock, they've intimidated victims, they've threatened witnesses, and they have essentially destroyed evidence, and they've succeeded. And now they can't be prosecuted, they can't be exposed, and this is a bill that will help them do it. Let me talk real quickly about some of these specific things. He talked about the passage of time hurting. Well, of course it hurts. You know who it hurts? It hurts us. The burden of proof is on us. It's not on Mr. Gorski and his clients. As a matter of fact, he talked out of both sides of his mouth because you heard him say that there were tens of thousands of documents that they had to wade through when these cases came forward. And frankly, there have been cases in California brought under the window where victims were told, yes, you have a legal right to file a lawsuit. Unfortunately, we've not been able to find any other victims. We've not been able to find any other records. You're out of luck. He talks about this slippery slope argument. I would beg you to disregard that on its face. It's ludicrous. Do you hear other organizations, other individuals, other aggrieved parties, other injured people coming to you saying, this man painted my house, he did a crummy job, he did it 25 years ago, please let me sue him? You know, that is a ludicrous argument. 5 years ago, the California legislature enacted a bill like this, and to the best of my knowledge, not one other institution or individual has come before the California state legislature saying, I was hurt as a child in some other way, and I need more time to expose my predator. The sponge analogy, I think Senator French did an excellent job of pointing out the real problem there. I mean, two problems. Number one, if you're a victim of bad surgery, you tend to be a victim as an adult and not a kid. And number two, a bad surgery tends to be an accident. There aren't a great many physicians who deliberately, recklessly, continuously perform crummy surgery. The problem, though, here is with child sex abuse. Child molesters do routinely, serially commit these crimes. And so we do have to make some special allowances about those two facts. The victims are confused, frightened, intimidated children, and the crimes are repeated over and over again. We do have to make some allowances in the law to take advantage of that. He talks about when the perpetrator is dead. Virtually every single member of our organization, every single victim who's ever called me, at some point in usually the first conversation or certainly by the second conversation, they say the same thing to me. They say, please, I just want to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And even when the predator is deceased, unfortunately, in this particular case with the Catholic Church, the rigid, secretive, centuries-old, male-dominated hierarchy, and let me repeat because that's what the church is structurally, it is a centuries-old, very secretive, all-male, rigid hierarchy. That has not changed. So if every sexually abusive priest in the country drops dead tomorrow, the need will still be there for this legislation. And secondly, 5 years from now, it will be another institution. It may be the Boy Scouts, it may be the daycare industry, but 5 years from now, you'll be sitting in the same room and you will be able to look at victims and say, we fixed it 5 years ago. And we'll be able now to go back and get those daycare operators who recklessly hired dangerous men. Two other quick points. He talks about the notion that that this claim that this is getting resolved on its own. again, I think that's just ludicrous on its face. There always have been and always will be child molesters. There always have been and always will be people who, when confronted with evil, will be timid and choose to do nothing, versus people who are proactive and responsible and prevent harm from being done. That's always the case. And child molesters always have and always will gravitate towards organizations where they have access to kids and authority over kids. That's true. A few years of bad headlines for one institution in our society doesn't radically fix that. That's simply human nature. That's why you all have to fix it. And finally, I couldn't agree more with Senator McGuire. The basic root of this bill is to, I would reverse the order. Number one, the basic purpose of this bill is to expose child molesters who are walking the streets now, who again have essentially gotten off scot-free, and those who have enabled them, those who've hired them, shielded them, transferred them, destroyed records for them. And secondly, it's to get at the truth. There's one way in our society, it's not perfect, but it's the best system known to man. There's one way in our society that we help get at the truth. And we, frankly, in SNAP believe that, as the Bible says, the truth shall set you free. And the one thing that Mr. Gorski and his clients do not want to do, and that's why they pay settlements, and that's why he and his colleagues all across the country fight this kind of legislation tooth and nail, is they do not want the officials to have to take the oath and in open court before judges and juries acknowledge how much they knew and how little they did about predators. That's their number one goal. When it comes down to it, fundamentally, it's a matter of preventing future abuse and exposing the secrets and the crimes of the past, or giving them, again, a free pass. And let me just quickly say that this is not a bill, again, that is directed at the Catholic Church. This is a bill that's directed at any child molester and anyone who is reckless enough to hire them, and anyone who is disingenuous and timid and self-serving enough to keep that person on the payroll instead of getting rid of them when the first abuse allegations come forward. I know I've probably taken more than my time.
A little generous on the 5 minutes, but that's okay.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to wrap up, you can go ahead and do so.
Well, thank you. I would. I guess I would simply say that, again, keep in mind that 90% figure, please. That, you know, if 90% of the if 90% of the people on your staff were embezzling from the state of Alaska and getting by with it, y'all would take dramatic action. And I would applaud you for doing so. And fundamentally, again, remember that the burden of proof, you know, falls on us. Is there the chance that if this law passes, there'll be a false claim? Absolutely there is. Anytime you open the courthouse doors in the morning and unlock them, there's a chance that there's going to be a false claim. But fundamentally, we've learned 200 years in this country, we've learned that juries do a pretty good job of sorting fact from fiction. And the church's own leading defense lawyer, a man who I'm sure Mr. Gorski has worked with, named Patrick Schultz, told the New York Times 2 years ago that he represented more than 500 accused pedophile priests, more than 500. This is not a plaintiff's lawyer, this is the church's lawyer. And he said of those 500 accused priests he represented, less than 10 were falsely accused. Let me just very quickly deal with the cap issue, and that is simply, I would beg you, before you consider caps, to ask Mr. Gorski's clients to disclose to an independent third party the amount of insurance, the amount of property, the amount of assets that they have. Church officials all across the country feign poverty, and then once cases get settled, they turn around and tell their membership just the reverse. Don't worry, nothing is going to change. Diocese of Orange County, California, $100 million settlement, the largest settlement in history involving one institution in child sex abuse. 6 months later, they repaid the loan they took out to pay it, and they are building a brand new, I think it's $150 million cathedral. So I would beg you not to be moved by those kinds of arguments. And the other argument about caps to remember is if the goal is to deter recklessness and wrongdoing and secrecy and destruction of evidence, intimidating witnesses and scaring victims, if that's the goal, keep in mind that caps certainly won't help in that respect. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate the time, and I'd be glad to take questions.
Questions from members of the committee. For Mr. Closey?
Clossy.
Clossy. I'm very grateful to be here.
Clossy. You can mispronounce my name all day long. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you all very much.
The members of the committee should have three documents with respect to ex post facto. I appreciate Mr. Gorski's not focusing on that as a as the centerpiece of his opposition to the bill. Nevertheless, I think it's important for the committee to consider the arguments that were advanced. if I'm just going to take about 2 minutes and run through those arguments so that we have a record. I'm going to start with the decision from 2006, from just about 6 months ago, entitled Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska versus John Doe's 1 through 6. And it's this document. It's a Lexis document. And on page 6 of that, it says, with respect to the 2001 changes regarding statute of limitations, it says, had the legislature intended to apply retrospectively, it would have used similar language. That the legislature chose not to add such language when considered along with the legislative history and the statutory presumption against retroactive statutes leads us to conclude that AS...
I haven't found that document.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Still beg your pardon.
Through. What are we looking at?
This is a court decision entitled Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska versus John Doe's 1 through 6 respondents.
Okay, well, page 6.
And I'm on page 6 of that document on the right-hand column. And the court is discussing whether the change in the law in 2001 applied retrospectively, whether it looked backwards. And the shorthand recitation of what they decided was that it did not revive time-barred claims. I'm looking at the top of that page on the right-hand column. It says, in the sentence just before the indented matter, it says, thus we conclude that the plaintiffs cannot rely on this statute as a basis for their claims. So in essence, the court said no. The change in 2001 did not look backwards, it only looked forwards. And it notes in that little indented claim, the Senate Judiciary Committee meetings talks about Mr. Luckup telling us that the ex post facto clause would forbid a time-barred prosecution of sex abuse claims, and then goes on to discuss that a little bit more without resolving whether a retrospective change on the civil statute of limitations would be a violation of the ex post facto law. We then have, I'm going to turn now to the to the memorandum we got dated March 30th from Mr. Bailey. And Mr. Bailey concludes by saying that it may be a violation, it may not be a violation. He was equivocal. I think it's only fair to say that. I guess I would point out by, in his opinion, that he notes that there's authority from other jurisdictions finding that constitutional prohibition against ex post facto laws applies only to criminal laws. He couldn't find an Alaska case that definitively states that it only applies in the criminal setting from Alaska. On page 2, he points out that the Attorney General, in their opinion at the top of the page, that ex post facto laws relate to crimes and criminal statutes only. On the page, on the third page, in about the middle of the page, he points out that in other Alaska cases, the Alaska Supreme Court has held in criminal cases an extension of the statute of limitations was a procedural change that did not violate ex post facto. And I guess in State v. Hawkins, in the middle of that page, in page 3, Mr. Bailey pointed out that the Alaska Supreme Court upheld a retroactively applied criminal law requiring the registration of sex offenders. And as I thought about that in preparation for the hearing, I thought, well, it says a couple things. One, and I think probably most tellingly, I think the court would view a statute of limitations change in this subject matter somewhat leniently, if you will, given that they were willing to allow a retroactive criminal law with respect to registration of sex offenders. That was a hotly contested matter. I remember it was in the state, I just left the DA's office, and it was being litigated at the time as to whether we could go back and make folks who were convicted sex offenders register. And that opinion came down in favor of tough prosecution. Finally, there's a rather thick document that you have, a United States District Court decision out of the Southern District of California. A lot of the decision discusses matters that really aren't before the committee, but on page 21.
What's the front of that document?
It looks like this. United States District Court. On page 21, the court gets around to the ex post facto clause decision or matter or issue is the right word. And at the last paragraph on page 21, the court points out that the ex post facto clause of the U.S. Constitution prohibits the federal government states from enacting laws with certain retroactive effects. It goes on the next page, page 22, to point out some of the cases that have been decided on this subject. The second case is actually Culver versus Bull from 1798, one of the first Supreme Court decisions in the history of the country. And after examining that decision carefully, the court concludes at the bottom of page 22 that the California law upon which this one is modeled does not impose a criminal penalty. It is not an extension of criminal punishment. Therefore, the California law simply extends the statute of limitations for the filing of civil tort claw action and is not, therefore, an ex post facto problem. So that's the analysis of at least one other court on the law, like the one in front of us. So I think it's fair to say that I think the law leans in the direction of this not being an ex post facto problem. It's certainly not clear cut. I would not say it's black and white. I'd say it simply leans that direction. And that's something that the court, or we should keep in mind. While I've been talking, we have one other person who's online who wishes to testify on this bill, and that's Mr. Joe Austin. Mr. Austin, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
If you'd put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, the committee would be happy to hear your testimony. In the interest of time, please try to keep it to a few minutes.
Oh, I will. My name is Joe Austin. I'm not affiliated with any organization in regards to this bill, Senate Bill 112. I'm here as a concerned citizen for the protection of children victims. If I can just give you briefly a little bit about my background, I'm a retired Anchorage Police Department investigator, and I've worked most of my, well, I should say most of my tenure at the police department was working in investigations, about 7 years in the homicide unit. I worked also sex crimes, and I organized and supervised the Crimes Against Children unit back in the early 90s. I have testified also in Superior Court as an expert in child abuse and exploitation investigations. And if I could just throw out a few statistics here for you. From 1992, I dug up one of my old statistics that I kept. And in 1992, we had over 1,700 cases reported to the Crimes Against Children Unit. And of those, I assigned about 700 out to the nine investigators I had working in the unit. The ones that we couldn't investigate or didn't investigate were because of obviously things like no crime was committed, there was a lack of enough evidence to prosecute a case beyond a reasonable doubt, and of course there were the cases that were outside the statute of limitations. This became rather frustrating to me, so in the early 90s, in fact in 1990 I believe, I approached then Senator Donnelly, and a bill was introduced changing the statute of limitations. I believe it was for 10 years past a person's 16th birthday. And of course, since then, the bill for crimes against children and or sex crimes, I should say, was the statute of limitation was removed in 2001. Now, turning back to the Crimes Against Children unit itself, we investigated all manner of child maltreatment, from neglect to physical abuse, infanticide, and sexual abuse. Of those, I estimate about two-thirds of our caseload was sexual abuse. And most of those cases involved intrafamilial abuse, usually by the father, stepfather, and uncle. Of the extrafamilial cases, those involved the true pedophile, the preferential child molesters, and who are, in my opinion, the most dangerous, because you can have hundreds of dozens of victims, if not hundreds. And I do recall one case where we estimated over the years he had molested over 400 kids. The type of preferential child molesters you have include all professions: school teachers, police officers, ministers, Boy Scout leaders, counselors, and of course the friendly neighbor with all the toys for the kids to come around. And what I found, in based on my experience, that victims do not always report sexual abuse or sexual assault until years after they were victimized for various and complex reasons. And in my opinion, by passing Senate Bill 112, victims who are now barred under the current statute will be afforded the opportunity to have their day in court and possibly allowing them to begin the healing process. Another benefit to this is that it will be a benefit to all of the citizens of Alaska because of the exposure of these child predators who have remained under our radar for years. Also, by enacting this legislation, evidence could be discovered allowing law enforcement to investigate and prosecute these predators. Public exposure will help prevent future victimization. I am supporting and asking your support for Senate Bill 112, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Austin from members of the committee. Mr. Austin, I don't see any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here or online that would like to testify on Senate Bill 112? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Senator McGuire, are you considering an amendment to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had two questions for you. I gave you a heads up that I would ask. The first is I just wanted an answer on the record as to why we're excluding 09-10-140. And the second is, why only 1 year? Why are we repealing it for a year? If the premise is that there is secrecy, there's intimidation, there are lots of things working against somebody reporting these kinds of crimes in the past, maybe some of those things residually still exist. And I just wanted to hear discussion about why 1 year versus five versus two versus three versus none at all.
It's a fair question. It's essentially a policy. It's a balancing test. It's a test between a total opening of the doors and confronting the issues that Mr. Gorski raised with respect to fairness and time and so forth, and the idea that since 2001, since it's been, since we have no statute of limitations from that day forward, you do have, I guess, a narrowing sort of number of individuals to whom this applies. And the idea is that given the publicity that's been in the public, 1 year window would allow folks who haven't come forward to come forward. And at that point, then you enter a state of repose where folks can go forward, at least knowing that they're only confronting cases from that day forward.
Okay, and then on the first one?
With respect to the actually, your question was about why just basically felony sex abuse and not misdemeanor sex abuse. And again, it's a balancing and a policy call. You could make all claims available, I guess, under the bill, but the given the severity of the felony, the penetration claims versus the touching claim, given the difficulties in proving a touching claim versus a penetration claim, it just struck me as being a rational place to put the balance. Okay. Senator Terrio.
And Mr. Chairman, did you consider a cap or, you know, all court costs or, you know, funds that would go into a victim's compensation fund? Or, you know, I don't know whether we're dealing with a cottage industry that's, you know, building up and bringing this type of case around the nation and now, you know, proposing to bring it in the state of Alaska. And I'm a little bit concerned that everybody that we've had testify, we've had either psychologists that are involved in these cases, we've had victims, we've had attorneys on one side or the other, and we haven't had anybody just from the judiciary just to tell us if we were just writing this whole section of statutes without any cases, where would we strike that balance? And I'm afraid that when we're potentially changing something that's been goes back to England, I mean, we're talking old common law, whether, you know, without the emotion, where would we strike this balance? And we haven't had any testimony yet on the change to the system. And I wish we'd have an opportunity to hear from a retired judge or somebody that really doesn't have a dog in the fight on the change that we're about to, or that we're considering, especially since we're the only committee referral on the Senate side. And as far as looking at the changing in the legal system, this would be the appropriate committee.
I try to be as sensitive as possible to the fact that this is a single committee, and that's why we've been, you know, we waited for witnesses who are out of country, and you know, so I'm sensitive to that idea. I don't know if you can get a completely disinterested individual. I think actually Mr. Gorski gave us a good, you know, sort of explanation of why you have a statute of limitations in general, and then we've heard reasons for and against why it should apply to this specific cause of action, a sex abuse, a sex assault cause of action. I think, you know, the policy call is there. It's whether you revive these claims that have been time barred and whether we accept that fear, shame, alcoholism, or, you know, beating for your father, you know, sort of overcomes what are now, I think, fairly tight legal reasons for not disclosing. That is, fear, I don't think, is going to be enough of a reason for a court to say that tolls the statute of limitations. They're gonna want more psychological evidence than just fear or shame for you not disclosing. Senator McGuire.
Only one other point that I wanted to think about, but I don't think there's a way to deal with it. I toyed with it over the weekend in my mind, and that was the thought that there are members of church that tithe, and I was thinking about it. My church, I do, even when, and we were discussing, even when sometimes financially it would be easier not to. And the only thought that I had was, has any other state considered excluding the tithe money outside of and separate from what's in the diocese or in the Boys and Girls Club if there's, you know, sort of dollars that are given? I don't think there's a way around it, frankly. I'm just sort of expressing on the record just that general reservation, that just the only little thing that bothers me, that there are folks that have given a lot of their hard-earned money believing that a certain thing was going on that wasn't, and sadly it wasn't in some cases. But I suppose there isn't a way of separating out those monies versus others, right?
I can't imagine a more painful process to enter into.
So, yeah.
Senator Huggins.
Yes, Senator French, thank you, for Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, my concern is that, I mean, there is some economic factors here, and I would be interested to see in past cases what the victims ended up with out of the judgments versus where the monies went. I mean, I think that's important for us to understand the ramifications, and I'm not sure about cottage industry and, you know, the as cited by Mr. Austin, as I recall. I mean, it's heart-wrenching, and I Klossy. Agree. I'm
sorry. Klossy. This is Mr. Klossy here.
Yeah, Mr. I'm sorry.
Wait, Gorski and Klossy.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Just over the
but,
record.
But,
yeah.
but in any event, I mean, these things are terrible. And but on the other hand, it kind of turns to who are we punishing now? If X number of them are dead, and you mentioned about the tithing and where the derivative of the money is, and you know, a lot of people owe their salvation to the church, not to defend anybody that protected these people, because, I mean, I would be one to go and I would help chisel on somebody's gravestone that they were a sexual pervert. I would have no problem and put a little red signature on it for Alaskans. But in the same token, I would be interested to see what the divisions of monies look like and how much actually ends up to the victim.
Virtually 90% of the settlements come from insurance.
If you'd come forward.
Yeah, in our
We do deal with the non-Catholic cases as well, certainly, but in our experience, 90% of the settlements come from insurance. So in that sense, the costs have already been paid by your parents and my parents and our grandparents. Is that addressing your question?
No, it's
question?
Not where it comes from. It's where it goes.
I think the question is,
oh, I see.
How much does a victim get from a settlement?
Typically between 30 and 40%, although let me hasten to add that even with a window, our experience is that the overwhelming majority of victims simply can't or don't come forward and pursue litigation. They're embarrassed that that kids will be taken off of the team that they coach if people find out that, you know, I was abused. They're worried about what their employer will say, their spouse will say, their family will say. So the majority of victims do not pursue something like this.
And I mean, I firmly believe that the accountability should be there. I don't belong to the Catholic Church. I've probably been a Catholic Church two or three times in my life, and two of those were for basketball meetings because they hosted them. And, you know, I probably knew a couple, three Jesuits and didn't realize that that was, in fact, their religion. But on the other hand, I mean, the victims, I think, should have their day in court. It appears to me this may, in some senses, ultimately be about dollars and cents and cash flow, and to that extent, it gives me a little bit of discomfort.
Well, I think Senator McGuire hit the nail on the head. What victims really want is they want their perpetrator exposed, anybody who covered up for their perpetrator exposed, and they want to prevent recklessness like that and the validation that comes the validation that comes when a jury says, yes, we believe you, something.
I concur with that. And the Scarlet Badge is one of the, anyway.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clossy.
Thank you very much.
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, and so many of the debate that we've had here in committee, it always has gotten back to these very bad cases, very bad acts in the church. But this is anybody. This opens the window up for anybody. Any Boy Scouts, which I've been involved in for 10 years, and child care and Girl Scouts and Brownies. I mean, it's any organization out there. So that's why I'm just really concerned that we haven't really heard from somebody that's disassociated with all the present cases to just give us some suggestions on how we might be tilting the legal field in a system that's been in existence for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I'm just not sure that we've had adequate discussion on, again, if we were just writing this entire doctrine from scratch, would we write it this way? And I, for one, if we're to be the only committee to consider this, would like to see if there isn't somebody that could give us some testimony on that.
Well, I can see that we're running out of time to deal with this bill. I've got another bill to bring up. So,
Senator French?
Yes.
Can we take an at ease?
Sure. Let's take an at ease. Go back on record. I think Senator Terrio has brought out that there are some policy concerns out there. However, the likelihood that we'll get a black and white answer to that question, I think, is fairly limited. We've heard from both sides on the basic structure of the statute of limitations, and so at this point, I would ask whether there is the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill Number 112 out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection?
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
To your objection?
Just that I think that there's nothing real time sensitive, and I think that perhaps we could find somebody from the judiciary that's really disassociated with any of the emotion that's attached to this issue, just on the sensibility of the change that we're contemplating here and the ramifications that it has in our legal system that's been in place for hundreds and hundreds of years. And this is the only thing I think there we could get suggestions that, well, if you make this change, you want to do it in such a way that you're not inviting a bunch of cases to stampede, maybe trumped-up cases to stampede through the window while it's open. And it just seems like we would take the time to consider that.
And to that objection, I would say that we brought this bill up a week ago, heard it, gave notice to the world that we would hear it again today. And that was, I think, the opportunity for folks to gather witnesses and gather the information. Any other comments, Senator Huggins?
I'm going to support the bill with reservations because I don't think it is that time sensitive if we do it within, you know, this session or next session, but because people will have, and I have all the sympathy is not the right term. I identify and understand the victims piece of it, but there are potentially large spillover factor that gives me some degree of discomfort. I won't be opposing it, but I'm not enthusiastic about the timeliness of what we're doing.
appreciate
Mr.
your
Chairman,
response
I'll,
view. And Senator,
I'll remove my objection. We'll just go with the individual recommendations.
Fair enough. Then without objection, the bill is moved from committee. Let's take a short at ease for the Well, let's get to work. The Senate judiciary will come back to order. Next up is Senate Bill 97, and we are here today to because the bill was referred to the floor. Upon deeper consideration, there was an issue brought to the attention of the body, and we're here today to take up that issue. Sir, please put yourself on the record, identify your affiliation, if any, and we'd be eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of Senator Stevens, I'd like to present. Usually, I've been having a slideshow that I enjoy sharing with the members. But
your name for the record?
Tim Lampkin.
Thank you, Ms. Lampkin.
Stevens. I usually have a slideshow to share with the committee, but in the interest of time, I thought we'd just dive right into the policy issues that we've been faced. Simply put, Senate Bill 97 is before you on behalf of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. At its core is a desire to help the Arts Council improve the Silver Hand program, which over the years has been stymied by fraud. 97 is truly a housekeeping bill with no motivation other than to modernize the statutes regarding Silver Hand permitting and to rejuvenate a program that's poised to blossom. Just as the bill began getting some momentum this year, it encountered a hiccup, if you will, by virtue of the legal terms being used in the definition section. Unlike most cases of the hiccups, where we're doubtful that, in this case, holding our breath will help resolve anything. So in that respect, we've prepared an amendment that should be before you and intended to address the policy issue of using phrases of recognized tribes in Alaska.
Let me stop you right there. Do all the members have an amendment that is stylized 25-LSO405/M.1?
Yes.
Seeing no
Would it be premature to go ahead and move this amendment? I do have two subcommittees at 3, and I'd like to help. Okay.
Likewise.
So I move amendment number 1.
Amendment number 1 has been moved.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Terrio. Mr. Lamkin, would you describe what the amendment does to the bill?
The amendment is essentially intends to avoid any inadvertent consequences of using the word recognized when referencing federal statutory language defining Indian tribes in Alaska. Senator Stevens would certainly not like this bill to be meant as a vehicle for getting the legislature in the debate of whether there are or are not recognized tribes in Alaska.
And let me just ask you, while we're on this amendment, how many years has this program been on the books, the program that allows Alaska Natives to get some special status, if you will, for their handicrafts?
Mr. Chairman, from 1961, so several decades.
More than 50 years. No.
Not quite.
40 years.
45. 46.
That's why you went to law school.
That's right. That's right. I thought, no way, I was born in 58, and I'm not quite. So the issue with respect to the amendment is just as to the definition of what is a tribe and what is not a tribe. Senator Terry, do you have other questions or concerns about the amendment?
I'd like Mr. Popley to testify on it if he's prepared to, on this specific USC definition from the Indian Self-Determination Education Assistance Act, what that all encompasses and doesn't.
Mr. Lamkin, if you'd let Mr. Popley come forward. Mr. Popley, if you'd put your name on the record, your affiliation, if any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted Popley with Legislative Council. Mr. Chairman, did you give a copy of that to the members? I gave you a stack of them in case.
This is the stack. If you'd pass that to Senator McGuire and Senator Huggins, thank you. If you'd pass that to Senator Terrio, Senator Wilkowski. We all have copies.
What's the specific question, Senator Terrio?
We're just always being on the lookout for an inadvertent recognition. I'm just wondering, utilizing this definition, what's the limitations on it?
Well, through the chair, Senator Terrio, as you know, you've worked on this issue for a number of years. We've worked on it together. The issue is controversial and, for the most part, unresolved from the legislature's perspective. And
when you say issue, just can I make sure you're talking about the federal recognition of tribal status in Alaska? That's the controversial issue.
Correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
It's not the handicrafts statute. Nope. It's not. Let's just be focused. Thank you.
No, specifically, Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrio, the issue being whether or not federally recognized Indian tribes with powers of sovereign governmental immunity exist in Alaska or not. In its simplest terms, is the issue that we worked with the sponsor to try to avoid this otherwise innocuous-seeming bill from muddling further. And that is the purpose of the amendments, the way you read them today, to try to avoid that issue being further confused in this legislation. There's lots of legislation that this body passes, federally has passed, that addresses Alaska Natives as groups, as you know. The danger is in putting forth legislation that otherwise would lead to the insinuation or the suggestion that the legislature either recognizes or wishes to recognize federally recognized Indian tribes for the purposes that some folks would have you recognize them, including the exercise of sovereign immunity.
And Mr. Popley, for the record, in your view, does this amendment resolve or lower, does it lower the likelihood that there'll be some recognition of sovereign tribes in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, amendments 1 and 2, I believe there's going to be two of them together, I think eliminate the issue altogether from this piece of legislation, which is what the sponsor would have liked to do.
Let's deal with one amendment at a time, because that's the one that I have in front of me. We've labeled number 1 and that I've had a chance to look at before this hearing. Does amendment number 1 take care of the problem?
Oh, it is all one amendment. Through the chair, yes, I see the amendment. I didn't have a copy of that. You're right. It is all contained in one amendment. And yes, in my opinion, it would keep this issue from becoming a central part of this bill.
So when you earlier referred to Amendment Number 1 and a subsequent amendment, you now see that Amendment Number 1 incorporates both the ideas you had in your mind.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Is there a further objection to Amendment Number 1?
No,
you
Mr.
Withdraw Chairman. Your objection?
We'll withdraw it.
Would you like a motion?
Please.
Okay.
Well, first of all, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. The bill is now back before us. Is there, Senator Terrio has his hand raised.
Mr. Popley, so would there be any need, in your opinion, to have any kind of boilerplate language similar to what Congress inserts into bills when we catch them, to say we're not intending to change the current status of recognition? With passage of Amendment Number 1, would such language be necessary?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, I don't think it's necessary. The insertion of the language that describes Indian tribes through the federal definition of what the Indian Self-Determination Education Assistance Act, if you read the text of it, it does specifically indicate that those lists, that list of groups, is strictly for the purpose of receiving benefits as defined by the federal government and for no other purpose. So it does have limiting language built into it.
Thank you.
Thank you. The bill was sent back to us to fix this one problem. We fixed it. Any other concerns while we're here, Senator Terrio?
The existing statute still has an equal protection issue, has for 45 years.
Thank you for that disclaimer and qualification. Is there a will of the committee with respect to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill Number 97 as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying. Hopefully, they're making lots of money, fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved from committee. Thank you. Please sign the committee report before you leave the room, even though we're all in a hurry.